Well, hello and welcome to Archaeology News Weekly. I am David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. And now the main headlines from around the world are as follows. The debate unfolds over the Lake Michigan underwater stones. A 5,500-year-old tomb is unearthed in Sudan, and the Neanderthal genome is to be unveiled. There's a new code of practice for treasure trove in Scotland, and we report on new discoveries at Mohenjo-Daro. Researchers unearth more of China's ancient past, and the Hobbit feud continues. Scientists argue over mysterious bones. Finally, we have news about ancient Tongan rock carvings, which may offer clues to these ancient voyagers. But first, a quick plug for the current archaeology conference. This conference was more than I could have expected, actually. It was very well attended in Cardiff, and I took copious notes, so I'll be writing this all up in the next edition of Past Horizons magazine. Did it inspire me? Yes, it did. Did it give me information that, as a professional, I found fascinating and relevant? Well, yes, it did as well. But did it also confuse the public or talk down to them? No, it didn't. There were actually so many highlights and so many great speakers that I'm actually going to have trouble fitting it all into the next magazine. In truth, if I was to actually pick out a single event, apart from the fabulous one where we were walking through the National Museum in Cardiff and a group of school children were being Neanderthal musicians, it was quite amazing to walk through this sort of silent and darkened museum and then be confronted with drums and whoops. Inspiring it was. That was from Steve Mithen. But yes, as I was saying, if I was to pick out one talk, it was going to be Professor Brian Fagan, who proceeded to talk without his images when, sadly, there's technology for you. His Mac refused to connect with the PowerPoint projector. But he managed to hold the entire audience rapt with the skill of a Homeric poet, I would say, as he went on to explain one reason why archaeology is actually relevant in the 21st century. He was examining the connection between the medieval warm period and what's happening right now with climate change. His words were a warning from the past, but there was also a bit of hope for the future. As he said, will humanity survive? Yes, we will, because archaeology has taught us that no matter what, we as a species Homo sapiens are infinitely adaptable. And although the world will change, as it always does, civilizations will fall and rise, we as a species, should survive. I came away actually thinking I've just heard a classic lecture. So will I go to the next one? It's in 2010, it's going to be in London. You betcha. So if you're going to be around them, this is the current archaeology conference, sign up because it is absolutely brilliant. I hope to see you there. And watch out for the next issue of Past Horizons magazine and the current archaeology magazine to read a lot more. Anyway, back to the news. 40 feet below the surface of Lake Michigan in Grand Traverse Bay in the USA, a mysterious pattern of stones can be seen rising from an otherwise sandy half-mile lake floor. It's likely the stones are a natural feature, but the possibility they are not has piqued the interest of archaeologists, native tribes and state officials, since underwater archaeologist Mark Holley found the site in 2007 during a survey of the lake bottom. The site recently has become something of an internet sensation, thanks to a blogger who noticed an archaeological paper on the topic and described the stones as an underwater Stonehenge. You'll probably remember we've also reported on this over the last couple of weeks. Though the stones could signal an ancient shoreline or a glacial formation, their striking geometric alignment raises the possibility of human involvement. The submerged site was tundra when humans of the hunter-gatherer era roamed over it around about 6,000 to 9,000 years ago. Could the stones have come from a massive fishing weir that was laid across a long-gone river? Or could they mark a ceremonial site? Mark Holley said that the first thing he said when he came out of the mortar was, "Oh no, I wish we hadn't found this, because it's going to invite so much controversy that this is going to be where we are for the next 20 years. This spring, though, Holley and a student from Northwestern Michigan College hope to make laser scans of the images that will yield a computer model. That will help scientists assess the site, which is otherwise off limits because of American Indian concerns that the area is sacred. Researchers who study early American Indians say that they will need more evidence to be convinced the stones are human artifact. They're especially wary of the idea of a mastodon petroglyph. Mastodons were facing extinction when early humans were on the scene, and the few that still existed in North America lived much further south. Evidence shows human families were present in northern Michigan thousands of years ago. They traversed a barren tundra dotted by stands of fir trees in pursuit of elk and woodland caribou. And they also gathered nuts and berries. People didn't really linger in such a cold, marginal land, but they did mine the chert for spear points from a site nearby and left evidence of campsites in the area. Northwestern University archaeologist James Brown commented that humans of that time frequently arranged stones to dam streams, to trap fish, and for other reasons. To satisfy Grand Traverse Bay's American Indian community, which wants to minimize the number of visitors to the site, and to preserve his prerogative to research the spot, Holley has kept its exact location a secret. He said he hopes a computer model of the gouges in the Mastodon Rock will help experts tell whether the features were a trick of chance cut by glacial forces or were the work of ancient humans. This is certainly something that needs to be investigated, as it would be unthinkable to leave it alone and just dismiss it. Well, I look forward to more on this over the next year. French archaeologists in northern Sudan say they've unearthed a 5,500-year-old Stone Age tomb, which they believe confirms the location of Africa's oldest human sacrifice. In a graveyard in Al-Qadada, north of Khartoum, the archaeologists have dug up the tomb of a man and a woman facing each other in a ditch, with the bodies of two women, two goats and a dog buried nearby. The discovery confirms excavations last year, which found traces of the oldest human sacrifice ever identified in Africa, said Jacques Orinald, a researcher for the French section of the Sudanese Antiquities Department. The unearthed bones date from between 3700 and 3400 BCE, a period considered to be one of the key stages in the transition from a hunting to a farming society. Reynolds' team also unearthed polished axes, a millstone, makeup pallets and ceramics. The Al-Qadada region, on fertile land alongside the Nile, is regarded as one of the cradle of humanity in the Neolithic era. The entire genome of a 38,000-year-old Neanderthal has been sequenced by a team of scientists in Germany. The group are already extracting DNA from other ancient Neanderthal bones and hope the genomes will allow an unprecedented comparison between modern humans and their closest evolutionary relative. The three-year project, which cost about 5 million euros, was carried out at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, and they're still working on the analysis of the genome's 3 billion base pairs. Comparisons with the human genome may uncover evidence of interbreeding between Neanderthals and humans, and the genomes of which overlap by more than 99%. This certainly has enough time for fraternization, of course, because Homo sapiens emerged as a distinct species around 400,000 years ago, and Neanderthals became extinct just 30,000 years ago. Their last common ancestor lived about 660,000 years ago, give or take 140,000 years. The genome may also deliver more details about how these species developed their physical traits, adapted to their environment, and evolved to fight disease. Despite previous reports that the German group's Neanderthal samples may have been contaminated with DNA from modern humans, an analysis of a Neanderthal mitochondrial genome has allowed the researchers to largely rule out such a contamination. The group will publish a first draft of the entire Neanderthal genome later this year as a single read of all the base pairs. However, some published human genomes had all their base pairs read 8 to 10 times before publication. I don't know whether I'm going to be able to read a book with 3 billion base pair bits of data in it, but that sounds like absolutely amazing news and a great step forward. And now something close to my own heart, being now a panel member of the Scottish Treasure Trove. The first ever code of practice for Treasure Trove in Scotland is designed to ensure everyone involved with found objects of archaeological, historical or cultural significance understands the procedures which enable them to be claimed on behalf of the public. Since ancient times, the common law of Scotland has been that Treasure Trove and other property which is lost or abandoned or has no obvious owner belongs to the Crown. They do not belong to the owner of the land where they are found or to the owner, to the Finder, but are allocated to public museums for research or public exhibition. The panel hopes that the code, available online and in printed form, goes a long way to explain the steps taken to ensure objects are allocated to the public museums, the length and breadth of Scotland, and that finders are properly recognised for their responsible action in notifying the discoveries to the Treasure Trove Unit. Metal detectors and the general public who discover any archaeological objects, not simply those of precious metal, can enrich our entire national collection in a significant way. There's no statutory definition of treasure trove, but it largely relates to what may be described as portable antiquities and can cover virtually anything, stone, wood, metal, even woven material, which has previously lain concealed and which is thought on the basis of its age and rarity to be worth preserving for the nation. If you want to find out more about that, just pop along to Google, put Treasure Trove Scotland and you'll be taken to the site. Archaeologists cleaning a drain to flush out rainwater from an explored part of the ancient Indus Valley city of Mohenjo-daro in Pakistan have been pleasantly surprised to come across artefacts and other objects of much cultural value at a World Heritage site. Well-defined structures of old drains were discovered along with artefacts during the digging, which was necessitated to prevent rainwater from stagnating at the World Heritage site. An object called an elliptical lid that might have been used for keeping holy water or ceremonial water was also found. Mohenjo-daro curator Irshad Rid said that this was something new for archaeologists. A miniature pot used for keeping medicines was also discovered. That's why the new diggings were being undertaken. They said it was both for constructing a drain and to study the phenomenon of the first street of the site. The presence of ancient remains and structures in the area under study showed that it was a very congested area, compelling the people to encroach upon the main street to construct new houses. UNESCO wanted to undertake a new phase of excavations at Mohenjo-daro to understand different aspects of the gigantic prehistoric city. Many questions related to Mohenjo-daro were yet to be discussed and answered, and it was therefore necessary to continue work on the site, where the last excavation at the present area took place between 1927 and 1931. Now there is a site I would love to get on and dig myself. So again, any offers gratefully received. In the remote village of Yangshe on the banks of the Yellow River, Chinese archaeologists are little by little bringing an ancient culture back to life after nearly 3,000 years. The vast cemetery they're excavating belonged to the rulers of the Jin state, which is finally emerging in all its remarkable diversity in what is now northern China's Shaanxi province. In most countries, it would excite the entire archaeology community, but in China, it's just one of a number of startling finds. They are undergoing a golden age in archaeology in China that has lasted from the late 80s until today. Archaeologists are in the process of excavating major finds throughout China that are helping to throw new light on what is arguably one of the world's oldest civilizations. In just one example in eastern Anhui province, archaeologists at an ancient tomb site have dug up what is considered China's first carved jade pig. The 88-kilogram pig dates to Neolithic times and was found with hundreds of other jade objects. At the Yangshe dig, the outstanding feature is a large pit containing 48 chariots and 105 horses that were buried with a Jin ruler, particularly noted for his military campaigns during the Western Zhou dynasty. The find is the largest horse and chariot pit dating from the Shang and Zhou dynasties so far found in China, and predates the terracotta warrior tomb of China's first emperor by more than 600 years. Among the finds are ceremonial carriages exquisitely painted with red lacquer, and which include finely crafted doors with bronze hinges. Armoured war carriages, protected by bronze plates, are also among the finds. They even believe the chariots and horses were the actual cavalry used in the military campaigns of the leader himself. The Jin Cemetery was first discovered in 1992, but funding for a major excavation only began in 1996. Since then, all 19 tombs have been excavated, with the dig of the largest horse and chariot pit taking 4 years alone. Coinciding with the discoveries, archaeologists in China are seeing funding on a scale that they could have only have dreamt of a few years ago. The Museum of the State of Jin, which begins construction in March, will sit on top of the horse and chariot pit and is expected to be opened by 2010. The $13 million museum will house a treasure trove of bronze and jade artifacts from all 19 tombs. That's brilliant news. So you can see, you can value archaeology after all. Perhaps I should start moving abroad to China instead of staying here in Britain. The story of paleontology's hobbits, the extinct human species called Homo floresiensis, packs plenty of drama. But the 2003 discovery of the undersized bones inside a cave on the Indonesian island of Flores has long also suffered from a modern-day human rivalry. Added in the scientific backstory, a five-year feud over whether the original inhabitants of Flores were actually a separate human species, and you've got enough material for a novel. The latest chapter in the story comes with the next Journal of Human Evolution, which boasts four reports concerning the hobbits, 5 years after discovery, which was disclosed in the journal Nature. The combination of primitive and modern-looking features assigns this hominin to a new species, Homo floresiensis. Australia's University of New England concludes the most likely explanation for its existence on Flores is long-term isolation, with subsequent endemic dwarfing. LB1's bones have enjoyed a rather rough few years, derided by critics such as Joachim Weber of Germany's Leopoldina Hospital as belonging to a microencephalic victim of a small brain pathology, so not a new species. Florida State University neuroscientist Dean Falk countered these claims in other studies. The bones then even departed from their home in Jakarta's Indonesian Center for Archaeology without the permission of all of the discoverers, a move that left them damaged and pawns in the politics of paleontology in Indonesia prior to their return. Another look at LB1 comes from the New Journal of Human Evolution papers in a study led by anatomical scientist Karen Babb of the Stony Brook University Medical Center that examines the asymmetry of the skull. Critics of the new species designation have pointed out the two halves of the skull are lopsided, suggesting microencephaly. However, Babb's report concludes that the cranium is fairly asymmetrical, but within the range of asymmetry exhibited by modern humans and all extant African ape species. Packed under 10 feet of wet mud, the skull likely became a bit distorted, a process called taphonomy, by fossil researchers. The whole microencephaly debate is nonsense, original team members such as Peter Brown have argued, as they have turned up bones, if not skulls, from about a dozen hobbits underneath the cave. The bones all display a similar look. A graveyard for microencephalics in a cave on Flores strikes the discoverers as highly unlikely. Two papers look at these post-cranial remains of LB1 and kin, in other words, everything but the skull. The hips, legs and feet of nine hobbits are examined in a paper led by William Jungers of Stony Brook University, and the arms, collarbones and wrists and fingers of six hobbits are described in detail by another colleague, Susan Larson. Overall, the bones most resemble those of Australopithecus afarensis, suggesting they arrived at the island of Flores a very long time ago. The latest papers include a better description of the cave, which concludes that whatever hobbits were, they ate a lot of pygmy elephant, Komodo dragon and giant stork remains also litter the cave, though there is less suspicion that the hobbits preyed on these species. More likely, they scavenged their carcasses. One thing the cave lacked, though, was seashells. Homo floresiensis probably descended from very early Homo erectus, or from Homo habilis, both human species that are known not to have used marine resources. Homo floresiensis probably did not have the right behaviour to exploit marine resources, perhaps with a fear of entering the water, just like orangutans. So we have many, many unanswered questions remaining. Well, I can't wait, though I can't believe that we have hobbits and dragons in the same cave. This is turning into a Tolkien novel as well. Discovery of over 50 ancient rock engravings in Tonga may shed some light on the pre-Polynesian Lapita people who voyaged across the Pacific. The petroglyphs, including stylized images of people and animals, were found emerging from beach sand at the north end of Foa Island late last year. Artist Shane Egan called in archaeologist Professor David Burley from the Simon Fraser University in Canada to investigate and document the site. The site on Foa Island is an amazing piece of artwork with over 50 engraved images, having an average height of 20 to 30 centimetres, but some much larger. There are stylized images of men and women, turtles, dogs, a bird, a lizard, and even footprints and other exotic combinations. He thought the images were close in form to some found in ancient Hawaii and dated to between 1200 and 1500 CE. If similar dating was found for the latest carvings, it would raise a question about direct long-distance voyages between Tonga and Hawaii in that era. The site is truly significant discovery in illustrating the remarkable Polynesian voyaging capacity in the pre-European era. The four rock engravings are on two large slabs of fixed beach rock that were apparently exposed by erosion. Tonga's previously reported rock art has been limited to a simple geometric engraving, though there's also a single engraved outline of a foot on a stone at a royal tomb. The petroglyphic foot was so rare that it was assumed to have been intentionally carved in a symbolic fashion. Pardon me. But the latest find changes that, and it may have been on a stone that was quarried for the tomb. The Foa site was recently found to have been a quarry for blocks used in tomb construction. Egan, who has a keen interest in archaeology and the early history of Tonga, said that now the images were exposed, they were within tidal range and were constantly being eroded. So let's hope something can be done to actually protect them as well. It just goes for me to remind you all about the amazing Past Horizons. I can't help but say anything about it's amazing. Get yourself along to www.pasthorizons.com. There you'll get access to hundreds of volunteer opportunities across the world. Of course, the Past Horizons magazine. Access to the Past Horizons TV channels as well. And so much more. And why not also pop along to Badger, B-A-J-R, where you can find out what's going on in British archaeology. There's new archaeology and heritage employment opportunities. There's a calendar of events, library, guidance section, and so much more. Why not even join in on the forum? That's www.bajr.org. And remember that more can always be found on the fantabulous Stone Pages, news.stonepages.com. Thanks so much for listening to Archaeology News Weekly. We hope you'll return again to us next week.